This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this Sunday morning. And of course, the same time we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And the show is always available there after the broadcast. And today we're going to begin our show as we have many days, and that is with an update on the COVID-19 pandemic. We get that from our news director, Dave Thompson.
The numbers keep rising. As of Saturday, North Dakota has had 94 reported cases of COVID-19. That's out of more than 3,100 tests. The state reports 18 have recovered, but there has been one death. In his Saturday briefing, Governor Burgum again emphasized that this data is latent, meaning it actually lags behind reality.
But let's just say in terms of our planning in North Dakota, we're assuming that there may be at least as many as 10 positive cases for every one that we turn up that shows up as a positive. And so, again, this is 10 days late in terms of data, and it may be underreported, meaning there could be 10 times as many cases. So the way to think about that, if we've got 94 positive in the state right now, that would be 94 positive 10 days ago, and it might actually be closer to 1,000 people that have contracted it. That's the way that, at least from a planning standpoint, we're thinking about it here at the state.
Burgum said that underscores the recommendations his administration has made, including social distancing, staying 6 feet away from other people, frequent hand washing, and staying home when you're sick. Also, if you've been traveling and returning home to North Dakota, you are always asked to do some special precautions.
So whether you're a college student coming back to North Dakota, if you're a traveler that's traveled in the United States or internationally, or if you're a snowbird that's coming back from Florida, Arizona, we are strongly encouraging returning residents to stay at home for 14 days after they arrive back in North Dakota, and then go on and fill out the travel survey online at health.nd.gov, and you'll receive information about what symptoms to watch for, how to self-isolate, and so on.
Now, State Health Officer Mylon Tufte has signed a new confinement order,
requiring individuals traveling back to North Dakota from all international locations and states that have been classified as having widespread disease by the CDC. This order impacts individuals returning in the future and those who have returned within the past 14 days. The list of states can be found on our website at health.nd.gov/coronavirus and look for the travel site. There are currently 23 states listed as having widespread community disease. It does not include our neighboring states of Minnesota, South Dakota, or Montana at this time. As an individual who's returning from travel or entering into North Dakota, immediately upon reentry to the state, you must quarantine for a period of 14 days. We encourage individuals to fill out the travel form, as the governor said, on our website, so that you know how to monitor your symptoms. And if you have symptoms, we ask you to seek out medical care, but please call before you go in.
Violating that could be a misdemeanor. The state is also preparing for additional hospital bed capacity should that become necessary. North Dakota National Guard Adjutant General Alan Dorman is heading the effort. He says this planning is looking at the worst-case scenario. Right now in North Dakota, hospitals have 2,098 operational beds. Dorman says they could expand to more than 4,700 beds if there is staff and equipment to do so. He says if those beds become full, another 4,000 could be added by using the campuses of NDSU in Fargo and Bismarck State College.
The one thing we like about the human university system is if you use an existing dormitory, the infrastructure is there for some of the other things you need, like food service, and the maintenance staff is already there. So that makes the most sense looking at those university facilities.
Governor Burgum said the state has 406 ventilators available right now. He said he and the team are working on finding more equipment and more people should that become necessary.
Just like we have that line on the chart trying to raise hospital capacity up, we're trying to raise staffing up, we're trying to raise PPE up, we're trying to raise ventilators up to get higher capacity because we need all those things together. And that includes working, we're exploring through Department of Commerce with North Dakota manufacturers, shifting their capacity to build ventilators. There's work about how can you get one ventilator to serve two patients. So we're trying to look at every possible way to expand that, because we want to get to the point where when the peak comes, that we are not at that point standing up here telling citizens in North Dakota that we came up short of either staffing, equipment, or beds. That's what the team is working on around the clock.
Also this week, North Dakota's K-12 schools will start offering instruction online after being closed since March 15th. The schools have submitted their plans for distance learning, and officials with the Department of Public Instruction and the governor's office have been reviewing them. But when asked if the schools themselves would physically be reopened, Governor Brigham said,
School buildings are for student access are closed indefinitely. Indefinitely doesn't mean, if you look up indefinitely, it doesn't mean forever. That means until we announce differently. And so until we announce differently, school buildings are closed for access to for students. And we're looking forward to getting the distance learning up and running and going by April 1st. And I said some school districts may beat that date, but excited to have our kids learning again. But as you saw earlier at the beginning of the press conference, our numbers are still going up. We're going to have to be on the way down before we start thinking about changing access to schools.
The state's colleges and universities are finishing the semester with online instruction. Brigham ended the briefing by again encouraging North Dakotans to follow the guidelines set by the Federal Centers for Disease Control.
I mean, everybody in our state's doing amazing work right now. And as we said at one of these very early conferences, if you're doing nothing more than staying at home, avoiding contact, following the hygiene rules, you're also a hero, because your actions may helping be save lives. So run it together. Thank you all.
There are still some questions on how the new $2.2 trillion CARES Act federal legislation can be accessed by North Dakota businesses and others. Brigham said there would be links to those answers on the state's ndresponse.gov website. For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Food security, from food pantries to shelters and soup kitchens, is a critical component of the social safety net for many in our region, and even more so during a pandemic. Last week, I talked with the president of the Great Plains Food Bank, Melissa Sobolik.
The Great Plains Food Bank is the one and only food bank in the state of North Dakota, and we serve the entire state and Clay County, Minnesota. And last year was a record-breaking year for us. We served over 102,000 people. So that's one in eight of our citizens who needed a food box or a hot meal last year.
And do you anticipate that this worldwide emergency of sorts will increase the need for you?
Absolutely. And we are doing everything we can, and it is all hands on deck right now, making sure that we have adequate food supply to reach out to all of the corners of North Dakota where people have maybe been laid off or their hours have been cut. School kids are now at home and families need to feed them three meals a day because they don't have that school lunch. We're preparing for a huge increase in need.
How many people do you employ?
We have 36. So we have 31 of them here in Fargo, and we have four people out in Bismarck.
And how are your employees adapting to the social distancing and all of those other requirements that people are taking in order to protect themselves?
You know, it certainly is a challenge. You know, not only do we have office staff here, but out in the warehouse, we have, thousands of volunteers who come through our door. And we have really beefed up our cleaning and sanitation and hand washing to make sure that our staff stay safe, our volunteers stay safe, and of course, we have safe food going out to people who need it. I know we have gotten a question about, are you still taking volunteers during this crisis? And we certainly are. We actually have a heightened need because we know that the needs will be increasing. And so we need to pack up more food than ever before. And we are making sure that our volunteers who are coming in, we're doing groups of less than 10 people. We are making sure that they can stay 6 feet away from one another and have very rigorous a screening process and hand washing and sanitation that all of our volunteers are going through as soon as they enter our door.
And what do volunteers do?
We are doing a lot of pre-packed boxes right now. A lot of the food pantries across the state have been client choice, where a client can come in and shop like they do at a grocery store. But a lot of that is being eliminated right now just because we don't want to have that direct personal contact. And so we're pre-packing boxes anywhere from 20 to 25 pounds of shelf-stable product, packing it up, and then getting that out to our food pantries.
Now, in the event of a lockdown order, and this has been the case in some states already, would your workers be classified as essential workers? I know in some grocery stores that's the case.
Yeah, and really we have been researching that, and it varies by state, but we have reached out to Governor Burgum to make sure that we would be classified as essential services and on the Minnesota side as well. So we're hoping that that will cover not only the food bank, but all of the food pantries across the state and our volunteers, because we need them to be able to come and do the work to get the food out.
Does a nonprofit like the Great Plains Food Bank risk any liability issues with volunteers during a pandemic?
That's actually something we looked at, and that's why we're doing such a rigorous screening. So as soon as a volunteer comes in our door, we're asking them, are you feeling well? Do you have a cough? Do you have any of the symptoms? Have you traveled both internationally or domestically in the last 14 days? And then we explain what they're going to have to do in our warehouse, which is hand washing, gloves. Anytime that they take their gloves off, or if our volunteer coordinators see that they maybe scratch their face, we're pulling them aside. They have to re-hand wash, re-glove up. And so that's how we're working around the liability, because we do need the volunteers just to keep our operation running.
Have there been changes to your mobile pantries?
That's a great question. What we have seen actually nationwide with food banks all across the country, they have been now taking up the model that we have deployed for a number of years, which is a drive-through model. So when we do our mobile food pantry, clients don't have to get out of their vehicle. They just drive up. It's like a drive-through. They fill out their paperwork, and we load the food directly into their car. And the only adaption we've had to make right now is that they are not filling out and we're not handing them paperwork because we don't want to have that contact. And so we're trying to stay 6 feet apart from them and just collect verbally all their information that we need.
Now, you provide food to shelters and soup kitchens, don't you?
We do. And that's definitely a challenge right now. I just got a phone call yesterday. Our soup kitchens are considered congregate meal sites, and so they can't be open right now. And they can only do like to-go boxes and hand those out. But as I'm sure you have seen, grocery stores don't have bread. And so our soup kitchens are really scrambling, trying to put to-go bags together to hand out to people without any bread. And so we're doing everything we can to get our hands on some bread for them.
And shelters, or do you just provide the food and then the shelter has to deal with the distribution?
Yes, that is exactly it. And so they are getting creative, about how to serve different people. I know some are doing grab-and-go bags. Some are doing frozen meals and sending. It really depends on what means the client has to prepare and eat that food.
You mentioned bread being a little bit scarce. Are there certain foodstuffs mm-hmm. that you're struggling to find?
You know, right now, bread is a big one. We also need a lot of shelf-stable product. What we have seen over the years at the food bank is more and more produce has been getting donated to us. And we're seeing that sort of level off right now. The shelf-stable product that we used to get from retailers and grocery stores and supermarkets, has declined a little bit. There are so many people who are going out, stocking up so they have those food items at home, and there's been less and less of that product donated to us. And we are faced with the fact that we may have to purchase some food that we would otherwise get donated. And that's something we're raising funds to do, and we want to make sure that we have adequate food supplies to feed everyone in need.
Remind us again, who are your principal donors of food?
They primarily the food industry. So we get a lot of our food donated directly from manufacturers like General Mills or Nabisco. We get a lot from retailers, you know, across the state, whether it's Walmart, Sam's Club, Target, various grocery stores. And then we get a lot of really great farmers who are growing extra produce for us and donating that as well. And food drives, you know, that's a great way to get some of a good variety of product into the warehouse pretty quickly. And so that's where we're getting a lot of our food. And, you know, we are looking right now to say, if those supplies start to dip, you know, which we're just starting to see this week, what are we going to need to do? And we know that the next step is to purchase product.
And how is your funding?
You know, we have just been having conversations about that. We figure that we are going to need at least another $500,000 to get the food out that we need to in response to the COVID crisis. And we are fundraising for that. We certainly don't want to turn people away. We know that there's an increased need and people are needing our services, and we want to be there to provide for them and their families. And so we are going to be raising funds to not only increase our distributions out across the state, but purchase the food. We know that it's going to take some additional manpower, and we are committed to doing that. And so we're hoping that the community, if they can, will help support us during this very tough time in our community, our state, and our world, and really respond to our neighbors in need.
Other than a fund drive, does the state of North Dakota, the state of Minnesota, provide some essential funding as well?
On the Minnesota side, there are five different food banks who are getting together and asking the legislature for some funding. I think the challenge we have on the North Dakota side is we don't have a legislative session right now. And so we may look to a special session or may look to the governor and reach out and see what funding is available. At this point, we know that, you know, that's not, maybe won't happen. So we are going to be very active and proactive to see what we can raise as well.
Since schools are shut down statewide, lots of kids are home now. And I know that there have been efforts by schools to provide the usual breakfast and lunches that they typically offer to students who meet the criteria. But I assume that your business is peaking a bit because of that as well.
It certainly is. And we have been providing backpacks for kids for about 10 years. Those kids who came chronically hungry to school on Monday mornings because there wasn't adequate food over the weekend, now those kids are home 7 days a week. And we've been working very closely with school districts to get them the backpacks that they have historically been getting to make sure that they get out to the kids who need them the most. But we also know that not every school has the capacity to do those grab-and-go meals, especially in the rural areas. And those families are turning to food pantries for the first time. They maybe have never had a need before, but now they want to make sure that they're caring for their child. And we're seeing that they need more food or that they're coming to us for the first time.
And if somebody does need this kind of assistance, what's the quickest, easiest way to notify you about that?
Well, the best thing they can do is go to our website, and that's greatplainsfoodbank.org. We have a list of all of the food pantries and soup kitchens across the state. We are keeping that updated. As soon as we hear about any changes in hours or adjustments that those agencies are making, we're putting that up on the site, and it will have all the contact info for those agencies as well.
You mentioned the 36 employees that you have, and, of course, there are other people everywhere where there are pantries and soup kitchens and that kind of thing. In the event that someone comes to work who's positive ultimately, and that means everybody else has to, you know, quarantine themselves. That could severely impact your distribution process, couldn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it certainly could. And we are taking contingencies. We have eliminated all staff travel, work travel outside of the Fargo, outside of North Dakota and Clay County. If anyone, and we haven't seen anyone who has been interested in traveling from our staff, but if they do, we are asking them, if you come back from an international trip or domestic trip, to self-quarantine for 14 days. In the event that one of our staff or our volunteers become infected, we will certainly remove that individual from that situation and follow, you know, the Department of Health guidelines about contacting other people and staff and volunteers and make sure that we are proactively addressing the situation. We hope that that's not the case, because that will have a huge impact on our services.
Is this something that might ultimately involve National Guard deployment, given the arc of the infections and the potential for, indeed, for it to disrupt your service?
You know, that's something we have seen other food banks across the nation do, where they have requested National Guard to be out handing food out in those distributions. And I don't know if we are there in North Dakota yet or in Minnesota, but we have seen how that happens and how it works in different states. And it is something that is on our radar. And if we need to make that request, we will do so.
I suppose some people are concerned about possibility of transmission of the virus on the surface of a food package or something like that. What do you tell people about the safety of the food you distribute?
That's a great question, and that is something we get quite a bit. And according to, you know, we're looking at the CDC, we're looking at Feeding America, which is really, you know, they're leading this effort nationally and making sure that food banks have all of the correct facts and information. And they have shared with us that the virus is not transmitted through food or water. It is transmitted through close personal contact. And so as long as we are cleaning and sanitizing all of the surfaces that the food comes in contact with, all of the volunteers, if they are, they have clean hands that are gloved, we confidently believe that we can get the food out quickly and safely. We have had questions, because it has come up in the news that, you know, can the virus live on cardboard boxes? And I think the latest we've heard is that it can live on the boxes up to 24 hours. And so anything that we're packing right now, whether it's in reusable bags, in plastic containers, in cardboard, it is sitting before it goes out to a family, because we want to make sure that they're not getting that virus from any of the surfaces either.
I went online to your website, greatplainsfoodbank.org, and noted that one of the services you provide is Kids in Distress Situations, KIDS. You're a provider of all kinds of things besides food to kids.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, you know, a really exciting project. If there are children's clothing or toys, that maybe there's a seasonal line change or leftover product after Christmas, we will get those types of items. We've gotten books and DVDs and shoes and clothing. And you know, we know that when a client is coming to get a food box, that's not the only thing they're struggling with. And so we do try to make sure that they can have those items, as well as cleaning supplies and toilet paper and personal care items that often get overlooked.
And when kids are indoors for extended periods of time, it's useful to have a distraction for them.
Oh, absolutely. Books and games, all of those things are wonderful ways to keep them entertained right now.
You mentioned the fundraising or food drives for the Great Plains Food Bank. Give our listeners a bigger picture of how that might work, how they might help.
Absolutely. And one of the great things that we have available on our website, so anyone who is quarantined or at home with their kids can still give back, even though you may not be able to get into our warehouse. We have a virtual food drive. So you can set up a food drive on our website. It shows all of the pictures of the different types of products. You can set a fundraising goal for yourself, and then you can email that out to all of your friends, your network, post it on social media, and it is a great way for people to get involved in, you know, a meaningful way to get food into our warehouse so we can get it out. And I think the important thing, too, to talk about is that for every dollar that gets donated to the Great Plains Food Bank, we can get three meals out. So $1 goes a long way. And even if that's what you can donate is $1, $10, we can make a huge impact in a person's life.
That website again, greatplainsfoodbank.org. And Melissa Sobolek is president of the organization. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
While the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum events are canceled until May 4th for public safety and health, children and adults are invited to stay home and learn about North Dakota's rich history with free resources at ndstudies.gov. This message was brought to you by Prairie Public and the State Historical Society of North Dakota.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Clay Jenkinson is a familiar voice on our network. In fact, his weekly radio show, The Jefferson Hour, follows this show. Clay is a humanities scholar, well known for his portrayal of Thomas Jefferson and another president, Theodore Roosevelt. In 2017, Clay joined us to talk about a symposium at Dickinson State University titled Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena, which is now the title of a new book, and Clay is one of the editors.
We do these annual Theodore Roosevelt symposia on the campus of Dickinson State. We've done 15 of them. They've been extraordinary. We've had the greatest presenters from all over the country and even all over the world come to talk about different themes in the life and achievement of one of the most colorful persons who was ever in public leadership in the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. And in 2017, as you say, the theme was TR, the naturalist. He wanted to be a professional naturalist and only turned to politics when he decided that that curriculum wasn't quite in keeping with his own views of nature and wilderness and conservation. And so we had really extraordinary presenters, including Char Miller of Pomona College. He's an endowed chair of environmental studies. He's a prolific author. And he's an expert on Roosevelt's friend Gifford Pinchot. And on Saturday, we always go out to Medora and to the Badlands and have our last discussion there. It's very informal. And the people who come, you know, get to ask questions they might not be willing to ask in a big auditorium. And towards the end of it, I looked over at him, and there were four, I think, scholars on the dais. And he looked over at me, and we sort of said simultaneously, there's a book in this. The presentations were so good, uniformly excellent, that we decided that this could be a book. And so we approached the University of Nebraska, and they generously agreed to print the volume, and Char Miller and I edited it. And every one of the presenters who had come to that symposium touched up their lectures a little, you know, gave them some footnotes and added a paragraph here and there. And then we invited a couple of other scholars from around the world to contribute other aspects of TR, the naturalist. And that book just came out, University of Nebraska Press, and it's called Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena.
Well, that title, of course, is familiar, and we should also mention that it's available now and that you were going to be on a book tour, but of course the realities of the world today have changed a lot of schedules, including yours. How did you and Char Miller distribute the work to create this piece?
Well, we encouraged all the presenters to, you know, to go back and make another run at their at their lectures, and they did. And then I edited them, and he edited them, and we each found different things to suggest. And so that got them into shape. And I knew of another presenter, a man named Elliot West from the University of Arkansas, who had given a previous keynote lecture at one of our symposia about Roosevelt's young life as a wilderness lover. And he was involved when he was a young man with the eugenics movement, which has, of course, been very seriously discredited. But he graduated out of it eventually. And so we wanted Elliot West to sort of place Roosevelt's intellectual formation, and he did. It's a brilliant lecture. And then Char Miller found two other presenters. And then I had also given a lecture at TR Island in the Potomac at Washington, D.C., on the 50th anniversary of that memorial to Theodore Roosevelt. And we used that, Char suggested we use that as the sort of the epilogue to the volume. So all those pieces came together, and we co-wrote the introduction, and we farmed out the index, because we knew that neither one of us had time, and two people can't index. It's a 225-page book, and it's got a great press, University of Nebraska. It's illustrated, and here's one really important piece of it, Doug. The images for the thing came from Dickinson State University's TR Center, the archives at the Theodore Roosevelt Center. We're digitizing the entire papers of Theodore Roosevelt. We put them all together, these images that pertain to T.R. the Naturalist, and those are in the book. So this is sort of a monument to the great work that Sharon Kilzer and other members of our staff at the T.R. Center have been doing to digitize the entire world of Roosevelt's papers, which includes newspaper clippings and diaries and letters in and letters out and cartoons and film clips and pieces of audio and photographs too.
The accessibility of history is one of the wonders of the 21st century, I think. How is the book put together? How do you tell the story? Is there an arc to it? Does it go linearly through his lifetime? How does it work?
One of our presenters at that symposium was Darren Lundy, who is at the Smithsonian, and he actually himself is a naturalist, and he had given a really outstanding lecture, the keynote, in 2017 on T.R. the Naturalist. So it follows Roosevelt from his earliest childhood until his death. When he was around 9, he was on Lower Broadway at a store, and he saw this creature, this seal, that was lying dead on a slab, and he became fascinated by it. And so he then measured it with his measuring equipment and took notes on it and tried to buy it, and eventually got the skull when the thing was finally completely rotted. And it became the basis of what he called the Theodore Roosevelt Museum of Natural History. He even had labels printed up for this. And this was going to be his life. So Darren Lundy gives us a kind of a chronological look at the entire achievement of Roosevelt. And then we go in for separate chapters. So Char Miller writes about that key relationship with Gifford Pinchot, who was the U.S. Forester. We have a wonderful essay on T.R. and John Muir when they went together to Yosemite, and Roosevelt spent 3 days with the greatest naturalist and wilderness man of the country in Yosemite. He said it was the best 3 days of his life, of course. And I wrote one on T.R. and the saving of the bison. The buffalo came very near to extinction around the turn of the century, and everyone assumed that it would go extinct. But Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot and George Bird Grinnell and Scotty Phillip and a range of other people went to work on this, including one of my heroes, William Hornaday. And Hornaday is really the man who saved the buffalo from extinction, and he did so by going out northwest of Miles City and seeing the killing fields. And when he was there in 1886, he had a conversion experience and decided to devote much of the rest of his life to saving this creature. And so all these different essays were contributed by either the presenters who were at the symposium or people that we recruited. So we wanted to have a complete picture of Roosevelt the Naturalist and not leave any holes.
Well, you mentioned something that just caught my ear now. You talk about Hornaday and Muir and Pinchot and Grinnell, people that were very prominent in the naturalist and environmental and conservation I guess, movement of the late 19th and early 20th century. How important was that moment in our history?
Oh, my, Doug. You know, it's. I once asked Charles Wilkinson, who is the great environmental professor of law at the University of Colorado in Boulder, at a conference I was hosting, I said to him, Charles, is it possible to exaggerate Theodore Roosevelt's contribution to American conservation? And he said, absolutely not. You know, that he is the key player, that if there had been no Roosevelt, it's hard to think that Taft would have done this, or Woodrow Wilson, or McKinley, or anybody else. And, you know, the second round of it came from FDR, who was self-consciously trying to imitate his fifth cousin, Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt's importance is just is staggering. He set aside 230 million acres of the public domain as national park, national forest, national wildlife refuge, national monument, national game preserve. It's unbelievable what he did. And he also helped to save the buffalo. And he helped to create the management protocols that we use in the national park system. He and George Bird Grinnell created the Boone and Crockett Club, and the Boone and Crockett Club was our first non-government environmental foundation. And they worked hard to save Yellowstone from economic development. Railroads were going to go in, and luxury hotels for the rich, and mining was probably going to take place there. And Roosevelt and Grinnell and the Boone and Crockett Club stepped in and said, no, the national parks are not going to be for the elite. They're not going to be for industrial development. They belong to the people, and we want every single human being, whether it's Nelson Rockefeller or Doug Hamilton, to be able to go into the national parks and have an equally satisfying experience. There's not going to be a class system in our national parks, and we're not going to make them places of multiple use. They're going to be places for the recreation of the human spirit. So Roosevelt was a great man, and he surrounded himself with other extraordinary individuals who understood what was important. You know, he didn't always agree with John Muir, but he always listened to John Muir, and he became the greatest conservationist in American presidential history without any rivals, except possibly Jimmy Carter, and that's because Carter set aside, or helped set aside, a very large chunk of Alaska.
But this was a time of intense resource extraction as well. I mean, the iron ore mines in the northern U.S., oil was coming online in lots of places. Were national parks or these kinds of reserves that were federally ordained ways to sort of let people loose in other parts of the country?
Well, yes. So Roosevelt was a pragmatist. He didn't think of himself as a preservationist like Muir. He would not have agreed with Henry David Thoreau's philosophy of these things, or probably the modern environmental movement. He wanted wise, scientifically based, sustained use. And what he saw was that we were skinning the West. We were cutting down the forests without replacing them. We were mining in Colorado and Wyoming and California and just leaving these tailings to poison the water supply. And we were overgrazing the public domain with cattle on ranches like the ones that Roosevelt himself had in the Badlands of North Dakota. And he thought, this is insane. Just as we're really becoming the most prosperous and powerful nation on Earth, we're skinning our landscape, and we're drawing down the great resource treasury that North America represents. So we're going to have to conserve it. We're going to have to find ways to make sure that our children's children and their children will have access to these resources too. And so that was the basis of it. And of course, if you take the national wilderness, which didn't come about until the 1970s, but if you set that aside, as no one can go in except on foot, and then you have the national parks where you can be in, but you have to stay on the roads. And then you have, say, the national forest lands, the grasslands of North Dakota, where people have more economic capacities, more possibilities to mine for gravel or for oil or for coal. And then you get down to the Bureau of Land Management, which has a much more welcoming philosophy for economic development. So we've created this system of tiers, that the most magnificent and fragile things in North America we're trying to protect forever. And there are lots of them. I mean, our national park system and our wilderness system are the glory of the world. And then we have a second tier where some economic activity is okay, but it has to be done under carefully controlled federal regulation and user groups like grazing associations and so on. And then we have the BLM, which controls, you know, a very, very large swath of the American West in places like Utah and Wyoming and Nevada. And its management philosophy is, of course, we need economic development, but it's going to have to be done in a somewhat responsible way. It's not just a open season on those resources. So that's the political settlement that works for the United States. It's under some attack now. We'll see how it holds up in the 21st century. But a lot of this is Roosevelt's view that it would be silly to lock up the West, but let's lock up the very best of it.
Humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson is the editor, along with Char Miller, of the new book, Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena. Publishers Weekly, Clay, describes your book as a revealing and sometimes critical view of the 26th president. So let's get some examples of the critical stuff.
Well, as I said, Elliot West, who was a magnificent scholar, one of the very best historians in the country, explored Roosevelt's flirtation with the eugenics movement. And that sounds more awful now than it was then, but it's awful no matter really when you look at it. But Roosevelt graduated out of this, and he realized that this was not a responsible path. But what Elliot West shows is that so many of those early conservationists were eugenicists, that they were somehow born of similar motives and intellectual impulses, and so they needed to be separated. And eventually they were. And the second theme, which is one that I address in my essay on the buffalo, is that many of our public lands, our national parks, our national forests, our national game preserves, were carved out of Indian lands. And so, you know, you're looking for a national park, say, like Glacier in Montana, and you say, well, the Flatheads and the Blackfeet aren't really using it in any significant way. So this is like free. We have a special license. We're not displacing any white landholders with deeds to this land, or very few of them. And so these are easy pickings for national forests and national parks and so on. And a great deal of that happened. If you could have an overlay map of the Indian reservations as they existed, say in 1872, when Yellowstone was made our first national park, and then you looked at all of the national parks that have come in since, around 59 of them, a very large number of them essentially confiscated lands that were sovereign to one Indian tribe after the next. For example, Badlands National Park in South Dakota appropriated land from the Lakota, and as you know, the Lakota pushed back, and even in my lifetime, Lakotas have occupied parts of Badlands National Park and put up roadblocks and required people who come into them to at least acknowledge the Lakota's overarching sovereignty in such places. So that's another area in which we're not happy to be critical about Roosevelt, but we believe this is really the philosophy of the Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State, which is winning national and international acclaim for this. But our philosophy is, warts and all, that there's no point in looking at Roosevelt as an unambiguous hero. We need to look at him as a man of his times, as a human being with strengths and weaknesses, as somebody who made political mistakes but also had enormous political successes, as somebody who traded the rights of some for the benefits of others. In other words, he's like any other human being who has to make big decisions about important resources and so on. And it would be a really irresponsible thing for us to do at the Theodore Roosevelt Center to simply make him a kind of paper doll hero, you know, the man of San Juan Hill and the man on Mount Rushmore. So we get some criticism for this, by the way, because there are people that want Roosevelt to be a superhero. But we feel very strongly that the more we tell the truth as we understand it, the better service we're actually doing to presidential history, to Roosevelt studies, and to, as you know, America's unfolding reassessment of the things we all thought we knew when we were back in grade school.
Theodore Roosevelt National Park in western North Dakota is awfully close to a very important resource play. How do you think the 26th president would view the adjacency of that to the park with his name?
Well, that's a good question. So in my essay at the end of this book, I talk about Roosevelt and monuments. And he did not really want a monument in Washington, D.C., or he was against statues. In fact, our governor, Hanna, of North Dakota, wrote him and said, "We're going to put up a statue of you on the Capitol grounds. Is that okay?" And it's, I quoted in this book, Roosevelt wrote back and said, "No, that's a mistake. It's too early, for one thing. I'm still alive, and history needs to make some assessments about, you know, whether I deserve such things." But also, he said, wouldn't it be more appropriate to put up a statue of pioneers, of people who actually did the hard work and struggle to make North Dakota happen?" So he was surprisingly humble about this, and the family has always been a little bit edgy about monuments to Roosevelt. But, you know, I'm sure he would be glad that the only national park that's named for a human being is named for him, and it's exactly in his old stomping grounds in western North Dakota. And the 70,000 acres of TR National Park in three units are protected against economic development. But just outside the perimeter, as you well know, Doug, it's national forest land or private land. And there, the development protocols are looser. And so you can see from Buck Hill in the south unit of the park, many, many oil-based industrial installations in Cottonwood Campground, which is the only campground in the south unit. You can hear the traffic on Interstate 94 through the night. This is a somewhat compromised park, and there is now, as you probably know, there is a proposal to do wholesale, sort of over the moon, oil development between the south unit of the national park and the north unit, including just around and embracing the Elkhorn Ranch unit. Now, that all may be changing because the price of oil has plummeted to around $30 per gallon, and nobody can develop that oil at that price. But I don't think this is going to go away. So what would Roosevelt think? Well, we try to avoid weighing in on that sort of a question at the TR Center because, A, we just don't know. And as I've said, he was for sustained conservation, wise use, and that for him included economic development. So, you know, some of this is probably fine. I think that Wayne Stengem's proposal of a few years ago of designating some special or extraordinary places and tiptoeing around them, not prohibiting development, but tiptoeing around them, would have suited Theodore Roosevelt perfectly well. But we just finally don't know what he would think. But I think he would think it's pretty hard to really feel you're in the wilderness when you can hear an 18-wheeler roaring by on Interstate 94, or when you can see the flaring at seven or eight different wells from Buck Hill.
We've been talking about Clay Jenkinson's new book. He co-edited it with Char Miller, Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena. Clay, you're also working on a new film about Roosevelt in popular culture. We've got a couple minutes left. Can you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, the film is an amazing project that Dickinson State helped to create. The film is by Michael Cullinane, who is an American, but he's actually working in a British university now. And he contacted us because he wanted to make a film about TR Island. TR Island has been there for 50 years. I got to give that speech on that anniversary, and he wanted to do a documentary because most people don't know that Roosevelt has a monument in Washington, D.C. And so the film is called The Man on the Island, and it's almost an hour long. We're hoping to bring it to North Dakota once this plague clears, and we want to show it at the Fargo Theater and in other places. We played a role in it. I got to interview Michael Cullinane, who's the lead, and Dickinson State provided its image base, as usual, in high-resolution photographs so that they could be incorporated into the film. One of the first things we did when we created the TR Center was get a grant to work with six national park properties, including our own TR National Park, but also TR Island, to digitize their holdings, including their photographic base. And so we were in a unique position at the TR Center to be able to help fulfill this project, and we're proud of it. And so that's something else that we've been able to do. And my point is that, you know, we may or may not have a TR National Library anytime soon. I do believe we will in western North Dakota. But meanwhile, the TR Center is going about its humble but extremely important business of digitizing all of Roosevelt's papers. And in addition to that, We serve as an advisor to projects like Cullinane's film. We're producing publications like this book, Theodore Roosevelt, the Naturalist in the Arena. We do exhibits, and of course, we do our annual symposia. So we're doing the hard work of disseminating the good news and our explorations of Roosevelt to a much wider audience than can appear in that auditorium every September.
Clay Jenkinson is the co-editor of Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena, and as you mentioned, working on a new film about Roosevelt in popular culture. It's always a pleasure to talk with the North Dakota native son and humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you, and I hope to see you in person one of these days.
Likewise. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, sir.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco.
Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning wherever you are when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Beginning at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.